July was a song that Brittany and Tina, also known as Minnie Mouse, were singing. I will build my life upon your love. That's a good theme for what I'm going to be talking about this morning. So would you join your hearts with me in prayer? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, who sent your word to live among us. Amen. Howard Thurman was 7 years old when his father, who worked on a crew building a railroad in Florida at the beginning of the last century, came home from work and collapsed on the living room floor. 5 days later, his father died. My father was a good man, Thurman wrote in his autobiography, but the church was not for him. Still, his mother and grandmother were active in their church and expected that his father's funeral would be there. The minister told them no, because Saul had died, in the words of the time, out of Christ. He was considered a sinner since he did not go to church. Good news for all of you this morning. Eventually, Thurman's family got the deacons at the church to agree to hold the funeral there, and an itinerant minister came to preach the funeral. I listened with wonderment, and then anger, and finally mounting rage, Thurman wrote, as the minister preached my father into hell. This was his chance to illustrate what would happen to sinners who died out of Christ. When the funeral was over, Thurman asked his mother and grandmother why the visiting preacher, who did not know his father at all, would say such things. They had no answers. But Thurman knew what he would do. One thing is sure, when I grow up and become a man, I will never have anything to do with the church. This moment for 7-year-old Howard Thurman was almost like the reverse of the story that we heard today about Saul, the persecutor of Christians, who was knocked to the ground by a flash of light and then went in blindness to Damascus, where eventually he would become one of Jesus' most avid advocates. Thurman's encounter with the church left him bitter and alienated from religion. He was hardly the only person to have had such an awful experience in church. More about his story, and then about his sense of God's call in his life and woman. Over the past few Sundays, I've told some stories of people who have discovered God's call for them in a variety of ways. My main focus today is to offer some ideas about how we figure out what that call is for each of us, recognizing that God's call is not a static thing, and neither are our lives. This is not a one-and-done event. It may be an awareness of God that changes our lives dramatically. Think about the story of Saul becoming Paul out of a flash of light. It may be an encounter that causes us to change how we live, even as we continue with the basic roles we already have. Zacchaeus was a tax collector who used his job for his own gain at the expense of others. Nothing in the story of his encounter with Jesus suggests that he changed jobs, even though being a tax collector for the Roman was a despised occupation among the Jews of Jesus' time. But he certainly changed the way he went about his job after meeting Jesus. He understood how he could adapt the way he worked to live into God's call. I started with the story of Howard Thurman as a child and his rejection of church after the terrible way that the minister talked about his deceased father. That rejection did not last, at least in part because his grandmother nurtured him with love and care and deep faith, and in part because his immersion in the natural world around him helped heal his soul. When he was 12, he was baptized and eventually went on to become a minister himself. Howard Thurman matters because in so many ways he kept adapting his call to do God's work in ways that affected the latter half of the 20th century in some very dramatic ways. In the mid-1940s, he was the first pastor to co-found an intentionally multiracial and multi-faith church in the United States. His 1949 book, Jesus and the Disinherited, is still used 70 years later They help the church look at how it must end with those whose backs are against the wall. Perhaps most significantly, things he learned while visiting Mahatma Gandhi in India in the 1930s helped shape his philosophy of nonviolent resistance as a method of social change. His work on this would inspire Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as he became a leader in the civil rights movement in the 1950s. King often carried that book, Jesus and the Disinherited, with him as he traveled around the country. That leads to another story of how someone senses God's call in their lives. For King, there was a moment that really was more of a confirmation and encouragement for the path he was already on. He was being tested, and God's call clarified for him. King was 26 years old, the pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. He figured he would just be a young pastor serving a good congregation. But then the bus boycott started to protest the laws that kept black folks at the back of the bus. The community looked to him for leadership, and he rose to the occasion. The white power structure was reacting with outrage. Day after day, there were threatening phone calls to him, to his wife, to their daughter. He began to hear stories about plots against his life. On the night of January 27, 1956, almost 2 months after the boycott had begun, gone to bed and was starting to doze off when the phone rang. A hate-filled voice spit out an epithet and then said, "We've taken all we want from you. Before next week, you'll be sorry you ever came to the government." King hung up the phone, but not surprisingly, he couldn't get back to sleep. He paced around the floor a bit, went down to the kitchen, made a cup of coffee, stared at it on the kitchen table. He was ready to give up. So he did the only thing he could think of doing. He prayed. He told God that he could no longer face this alone. Here's what King wrote about what happened next. "At that moment, I experienced the presence of the divine as I had never experienced him before. It seemed as though I could hear the quiet assurance of an inner voice saying, 'Stand up for righteousness. Stand up for truth. And God will be at your side forever.' Almost at once, my fears began to go away. I was ready to face anything." One of King's biographers describes that night in the kitchen as the most important moment in King's life, the moment when his political activism was transformed into a spiritual mission. It was a moment of calling. Last week, I told a brief story about Parker Palmer, an author who lives in Madison, whose newest book, On the Brink of Everything, starts with his awareness that even as he approaches 80 years of age, he's still on the brink of everything, learning to delight in the world as much as the 16-month-old daughter of a friend. Parker has written a number of pieces about discerning call in life, finding a vocation, a way of living out that call. As I wind the series down, I'd like to draw on one of his thoughts, along with those of a few other guides along the way. In his book from the year 2000, Let Your Life Speak, Listening for the Voice of Vocation, Parker wrote, "Vocation does not come from willfulness. It comes from listening. I must listen to my life and try to understand what it is truly about, quite apart what I would like it to be about. Listening, taking time to reflect, is a common theme when thinking about discerning one's call. And so is looking at the stories of others, like we've been doing these last three Sundays. But there's a danger in that. We hear of someone doing amazing things, sometimes at the risk of their own lives, and we think, 'I could never do that.' Karen Wright Marsh, director of Theological Horizons at the University of Virginia, published a wonderful, delightful book 2 years ago called Vintage Saints and Sinners, 25 Christians Who Transformed My Faith. Many of these are heroic stories. She noted that as she got up close to the personal stories of these vintage Christians, she said, I've met them in their humanity. They may be called saints, but they're also sinners. strugglers, and seekers too. From them she wrote that she has learned about faith as a journey through struggles and weakness into freedom and true strength. Or as author Lauren Luger wrote in the foreword to the book, I don't read about saints in order to imitate them. I read about saints because they show me something about myself. So listen to our lives, as Parker Palmer suggests. Listen to the lives of others, not to be like them, but to draw wisdom from them. These are two ways to sort through the calls in our lives. And notice, as it calls, the plural of the word. One of our calls might be to care for family, an aging parent, a growing child, an ill partner. One of our calls might be to serve our community. One of them might be to speak out on a public issue for which we have much passion. As followers of Jesus, part of our task in finding their calls is to root them in his life and teachings. I will build my life upon their love. So Karen Wright Marsh, when she talked earlier this year in Madison, offered six ideas on how to listen to our lives and to listen to God. She started with making space in our lives for prayer. And that might be as simple as times of stillness and silence, being attentive to the things that delight us and bring us joy. And then take the next right step. You don't have to have it all figured out. Feel called to work on climate change, don't feel like you have to solve it by the end of the summer. Just start and see where things take you. And if you find that's not the right path, that's okay. Maybe there's another better calling for you. Along with that, says Karen, be curious and try stuff. She put it this way: what threads of talent, interest, desire keep popping up? These are your clues. See where your efforts might reflect God's heart in the world. Be curious about how you might be a conduit of God's work rather than an agent of your own ambitions and others' expectations. It goes back to that line from Parker. Listen to what our lives are truly about, quite apart from the goals and ambitions you might have. Recognize your limitations. None of us can do everything. Sometimes we can't even do the things we desire to do. We may need to adjust our sense of call to fit the realities and responsibilities of our lives. Karen's last two suggestions: choose community and take courage. None of us can do this alone. That's one of the wonderful things about being part of a church community like this one. You can share your dreams and fears with others here. They can carry you along, perhaps join you in your efforts. That's the sort of things that happens at ECHO, where you all work together with others to help make some dreams come true. And it often takes courage to follow the call you feel you have. As Martin Luther King learned that night over the cup of coffee in his kitchen, you're not alone. God is with you. Let me leave you with a question from poet Mary Oliver and a few final words from Howard Thurman. Mary Oliver died earlier this year. She was a perceptive observer of nature and of people. One of her most famous poems is "The Summer Day That Ponders the World, Watches a Grasshopper, and Then Ends with This Reverie." I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And that leads to a question from Howard Thurman, which offers a way to think about what we might do with our one wild and precious life. Don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive, and then go and do that. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. Let's take a few moments to ponder that. And then let's join together in hymn 581. lead us from death to life.